Hello, and thanks for joining us for this episode of Into the Killing. If you know of any cold cases that were eventually solved that you want us to cover on Into the Killing, please visit our website, criminallylisted.com, then go to the Suggest a Case page. You can also suggest cases for our two YouTube channels, Criminally Listed and Paranormally Listed. For this episode, we're going back to July 1975. On July 5th, 1975, 31-year-old American Arthur Ashe won the men's single title at Wimbledon. He was the first black person to win in the 98-year history of the famed tennis tournament. Ashe was born in Richmond, Virginia in July 1943. He lost his mother when he was six. After his mother's death, his father became very strict. He started playing tennis when he was seven. He was eventually discovered by tennis coach Dr. Robert Walter Johnson Jr. Johnson helped Ashe develop his skills. In Ashe's first tournament, he reached the Junior National Championships. He won the Junior National title in 1960 and 1961. Ashe attended the University of California on a tennis scholarship, and he graduated with a business administration degree. In 1963, Ashe became the first black man on the U.S. Davis Cup team. In 1968, Ashe, while still an amateur, won the U.S. Open. In 1970, he took home another Grand Slam singles title, the Australian Open. Like Wimbledon, he was the first black person to win these titles. Ashe achieved another first for a black person in 1975. He became the number one ranked tennis player in the world. Arthur Ashe retired from tennis in 1980, and 5 years later, he was inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame. Ashe had health problems at the end of his career and in retirement. In 1979, at age 36, Ashe suffered a heart attack. He had a quadruple bypass and survived. He planned to return to tennis, but experienced chest pains while training. In 1983, he had heart surgery again. In September 1988, Ashe was suffering paralysis in his right arm. He underwent exploratory brain surgery, and it was discovered he had a parasitic disease, which was common in people who were HIV positive. It turned out that Ashe had contracted the virus when he had a blood transfusion during his second surgery. Arthur Ashe died from AIDS-related pneumonia in February 1993. He was 49 years old. In 1993, Arthur Ashe was posthumously awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. On July 6, 1975, Curtis James Jackson III was born in Queens, New York. He is better known by his stage name, 50 Cent. In his early years, Jackson was raised by a single mother. She was a drug dealer. Tragically, she was killed in a mysterious fire when he was 8 years old. He was raised by his grandmother. When Jackson was 12, he began dealing drugs. At age 19, he was arrested for selling drugs to an undercover police officer. His home was searched, and crack and heroin were found. He had the option of spending 3 to 9 years in prison or going to boot camp and getting his GED. He chose to go to boot camp. Around this time, he was rapping under the name 50 Cent. He chose the name because he idolized a young man named Calvin Martin, whose nickname was 50 Cent. Martin was a drug dealer and robber. There are two stories about how Martin got the nickname. One is that he went into a dice game with 50 cents and left with $500. Another story is that he would rob anyone for any amount of money. Martin was shot to death when he was 23. Jackson recorded what was supposed to be his debut studio album, Power of the Dollar, for Columbia Records. It was scheduled to be released on July 4, 2000, but it was never released. Months earlier, on May 24, 2000, while sitting in a friend's car outside the home of his grandmother, Jackson was shot 9 times. He was hit in the legs, hands, and face. It took 5 months for him to recover. It's believed that he was shot over a song he recorded for his album, Ghetto Quran. In the song, he details some criminal activity of drug kingpin Kenneth Supreme McGriff. It's alleged that McGriff ordered the hit on Jackson. The suspected shooter, Daryl Baum, was killed 3 weeks after Jackson was shot. Baum was a friend and bodyguard of boxer Mike Tyson. McGriff was never charged in connection with Jackson's shooting. In 2007, McGriff was convicted of paying for the murders of two rivals, and he was sentenced to life in prison. After Jackson was shot, Columbia Records wanted to distance themselves from Jackson. They refused to release The Power of the Dollar, and it's never been officially released. After being dropped from his label, Jackson started working on the mixtape, Guess Who's Back. It was released in 2002. Marshall Mathers, aka Eminem, heard it and he was impressed. He signed Jackson to his label, Shady Records. In 2003, Jackson released Get Rich or Die Tryin'. It was a massive hit, and according to Billboard, it was the best-selling album of 2003. Jackson released four other albums afterward, but none of them surpassed the success of Get Rich or Die Tryin'. Jackson has also had a successful career in film and television. He's had dozens of acting roles. He's also produced many movies, television series, and documentaries. On July 30th, 1975, 62-year-old Jimmy Hoffa went missing from the Detroit, Michigan suburb of Bloomfield Hills. Hoffa was the president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters from 1957 to 1971. Hoffa grew the union to be the biggest in the United States. This made Hoffa one of the most powerful men in America. Over the years, Hoffa made a lot of enemies. He also had ties to organized crime. So there was no shortage of suspects in his case, but no one was ever convicted in his disappearance. However, it's believed that the mafia killed him. There are many rumors about where Hoffa's body is buried, including under the end zone in MetLife Stadium in Rutherford, New Jersey. But it's all speculation because Hoffa's remains have never been found. On July 13, 1975, the number one song was Listen to What the Man Said by Wings. Since it was the summer of 1975, the number one movie was Jaws. Jaws was released on June 20th, 1975, and spent 13 straight weeks at the top of the box office. That summer, lifelong friends, 21-year-old Patrick Oliver and 22-year-old Susan Savage, were living in Walla Walla, Washington. Oliver was a pre-med honor student. Savage had recently graduated from the Washington State University with a degree in interior design. On July 13, 1975, the friends went for a picnic at Mill Creek. That evening, neither of them returned home. One of their relatives went to the creek the next day to look for them. Their dead bodies were found in some underbrush about 20 yards from the creek. 21-year-old Patrick Oliver had been shot three times, in the temple, heart, and arm. 22-year-old Susan Savage had been shot in the head and the heart. It's believed that the murder weapon was a .38 caliber or a .357 caliber Magnum pistol. The bodies were oddly posed. A lot of Savage's clothes had been removed. Oliver's body, which was fully clothed, was on top of Savage's body. The murders baffled the police. A year after the murders, the investigators were at a dead end. They had no leads or suspects. They have no idea why someone wanted to kill the pair of friends. Neither were involved in any illicit activity and didn't hang out with dangerous people. So why would someone murder them? There also appeared to be a level of professionalism to the murders. A relative described the shots as precise and surmised that the killer was a marksman. One thing the police thought was possible was that the killer was killed by a deranged maniac who would kill again. But in the years after the murders, there were no other similar killings in the area. So the case went cold. But it turned out that the police were right. Patrick Oliver and Susan Savage were the first victims of a prolific serial killer. The killer struck again 13 years later in Seattle, Washington. On December 28, 1988, the partial skeletal remains of a woman were found near Big Lake, Washington. She was identified as 23-year-old Stacy Elizabeth Hahn. Hahn was a sex worker who lived in Seattle. She was last seen about 5 months earlier in July 1988. She had been shot to death. The police had no reason to believe that Hahn's murder was connected to the murders of the two friends. Susan Savage and Patrick Oliver were killed in Walla Walla, and Hahn went missing from Seattle. Those two cities are 270 miles apart. Hahn was also killed 13 years after Savage and Oliver. Also, Han lived a high-risk lifestyle, while Oliver and Savage did not. Savage and Oliver's bodies were dragged about 20 yards, and it's believed that Han's body was transported and dumped about 65 miles from where she was last seen. The only similarities were that they were all shot to death in the state of Washington, which isn't much of a connection. So there was absolutely no reason to believe that one person killed Patrick Oliver, Susan Savage, and Stacy Han. For another 8 years, the killer was quiet. On June 14, 1996, two boys got off the school bus in rural Spokane, Washington. They found the body of a partially clad woman. The police were called. She was identified as 38-year-old Shannon Zielinski. She had been shot in the head. A plastic grocery bag was over her head. Zielinski was last seen alive about 3 weeks earlier. She had gone out to work in the sex trade. The police determined she had been killed elsewhere, and then her body was dumped. More than a year went by. Then, on August 26, 1997, the bodies of two women were found in different spots in Spokane. The first body that was found was 20-year-old Heather Hernandez. Hernandez was a transient involved in the sex trade. It's believed she was killed 5 days earlier in a parking lot, a short distance from where her body was found. She had been shot once with a .25 caliber handgun. After she was dead, her body was dragged into some tall grass near the parking lot. The second body was 16-year-old Jennifer Joseph, a runaway from Spanaway, Washington. Her badly decomposed body was found in a farmer's field. She had been shot twice, once in the chest and once in the shoulder, with a .22 caliber pistol. Jennifer was last seen alive about 10 days before her body was found. She was doing sex work in Spokane's Skid Row area. It's a three-block stretch of East Prague Street, known as the Tracks. The last time Jennifer was seen, she was getting into a white Corvette. The police suspected that the two women were killed by the same person. He killed Jennifer first, and then 5 days later, he murdered Hernandez. On November 12, 1997, the dead body of 29-year-old Darla Scott was found in a rural area of Spokane. Scott had a long history of sex work and drug abuse. It's believed she had been dead for several weeks. She had been shot twice in the head with a .25 caliber handgun. There were two plastic grocery bags on her head. The grocery bags became a trademark for the killer. The investigators surmised he did it because after he shot them, he transported the bodies and he did not want to get blood in his vehicle. A week before Christmas 1997, the body of another sex worker was found. The body was found a short distance from where Darla Scott's body had been found weeks earlier. She was identified as 31-year-old Sean Johnson. Like Scott, Johnson had been shot twice in the head, and two plastic grocery bags were on her head. Johnson was last seen alive on October 29, 1997, shortly after Scott went missing. On December 22, 1997, it was announced that a special task force had been started to find the killer. The day after Christmas was a bleak one for the task force. The bodies of two women were found in some brush. They both had been shot twice, and there were three plastic bags on their heads. They were identified as 31-year-old Laura Wasson and 39-year-old Sean McCallahan. Wasson had been dead for about 2 months, while McCallahan was last seen alive about a week earlier. The police found a fingerprint on one of the bags on McCallahan's head. However, they were unable to find a match to the fingerprint. The task force believed that the killer looked harmless and trustful. The serial murders were well known in the Spokane area, yet he was able to convince women to go with him. Often, sex workers will warn each other of rough or potentially dangerous customers. They reported some men to the police, but none of the men the police checked out was the killer. About a month and a half after the last body was found, on February 8, 1998, the body of 41-year-old Sunny Oster was found in a wooded area. She was last seen alive on November 1, 1997. She had been shot twice in the head, and there were three grocery bags on her head. While the task force continued to investigate the murders, another body was found on April 1, 1998. It was the body of 34-year-old Linda Mabin. She was in a shallow grave just 50 yards from where Wasson and McCallahan's bodies were found 3 months earlier. Mabin had been shot once in the head, and two bags were over her head. She was last seen alive on November 21, 1997. Like the other victims, she had abused drugs and worked in the sex trade. A little over 3 months later, the body of 47-year-old Micheline Durning was found in a vacant parking lot. She had been dead for 4 days. She had been shot once in the head. Durning had a history of drug abuse and sex work. Her body was found in the location where she was killed. The police noted that she was killed near a factory that manufactured circuit boards. The police questioned several employees, but no suspects emerged. The task force continued to investigate the murders. In 7 of the cases, they got semen samples. They were the murders of Darla Scott, Sean Johnson, Lori Wasson, Sean McCallahan, Sonny Oster, Linda Mabin, and Micheline Durning. Those samples were sent to the crime lab and a profile was created. They were a match to each other, which proved the same man committed at least those 7 murders. But no match to the DNA was found. The police now had the killer's fingerprint and DNA. They would have a strong case if they identified him, but identifying him was proving to be difficult, and unfortunately, women continued to die. In the spring of 1998, the police added another woman to their growing list of victims. She was 43-year-old Melanie Murfin. Murfin was like the other victims. She abused drugs and did sex work. She was reported missing in mid-May 1998. Her body had not been found, but the police did not think that this was unusual for the serial killer. Many of his victims were found weeks or months after they went missing. So they were working on the assumption Murfin was another one of his victims. On August 1, 1998, 30-year-old Christine Smith was working on the tracks. She was picked up by a client who drove a black van. He was friendly and sober. As they drove to a parking lot, he talked about himself. He said he was a National Guard helicopter pilot. Smith even asked him if he was the serial killer. He said he was the father of 5 and there was no way he could do something like that. He gave her $40 and she started performing oral sex on him on a mattress in the back of the van. After about 5 or 7 minutes, he had not gotten an erection. Then it felt like she was hit in the back of the head. She realized she was bleeding from the head. The man then demanded his money back. Smith said she tried to get out of the back of the van, but she realized the handle on the sliding door was missing. She was feeling off-kilter, but she managed to get to the front seats. The man grabbed the money from her. She got out the door at the front of the van and ran to a nearby rehab center. She was then transported to a hospital. There was a 3.5-inch wound on the back of her head behind her left ear. It took 3 stitches to close it. Smith talked to the police. She had a problem giving them an accurate description of the man. She said he was a white man, about 5'10 and 175 pounds, with a medium build. He had average length blondish hair, and his face was a bit pockmarked. No arrests were made based on the details Smith had given them. The task force built a database with different columns. The task force then investigated people who appeared in the most columns. For example, if someone had a criminal record, a history of violence against women, and was a known client of one of the victims, then the task force would be very suspicious of them. The police also thought that the killer was probably comfortable in the tracks area. They thought that a police officer possibly had stopped him while he was there at one time. They also believed, at least around the time of the earlier murders, he drove a white Corvette. But the police found no records of anyone being pulled over in a white Corvette in the Skid Row area. The police also realized that the tip about the white Corvette was problematic. For example, the Corvette driver may have had nothing to do with Jennifer's murder. Perhaps someone picked her up after that person. Or he could have rented or borrowed the Corvette. After all, no one saw any of the other victims get into a white Corvette. However, the task force considered the Corvette worth investigating. They got every record of people who owned Corvettes from Spokane County, Eastern Washington, and Northern Idaho. They learned that Robert Lee Yates, who lived in Spokane, owned a white 1977 Corvette. Yates worked at a circuit board manufacturing plant close where Micheline Durning was murdered. Yates was one of the employees who was questioned. They also connected him to the tracks at two different times. A month after the body of Jennifer Joseph was found, he was pulled over near the tracks while driving his white Corvette. But the officer wrote down CAM on the report, indicating it was a Camaro. This is why the police did not make the connection sooner. Then on November 28, 1998, Yates was pulled over after picking up a known sex worker. At the time, he was driving a 1985 Honda Civic. He told the police that the woman was a friend of his daughter's. He was not arrested or cited. So the police investigated Robert Yates. But they found nothing in his history that were indications that he was a serial killer. However, his family did have a history of violence. In October 1945, 7 years before he was born, his 54-year-old grandmother killed his 55-year-old grandfather with an axe. She was then confined to a mental asylum, but was later released. Robert Yates was born in May 1952 in Spokane. His family later moved to Oak Harbor, Washington. The family was Seventh-day Adventists. His mother was described as domineering, but not abusive. Yates idolized his father, who was a blue-collar worker on a naval base. His father was a hard-working, clean-living man. He didn't drink or do drugs. He coached Yates in Little League. Unbeknownst to his family, when Yates was six, a 12-year-old neighborhood boy sexually molested him. In many ways, Yates was average and didn't stand out. He was a bit of a loner who liked to hunt and fish. He sang in the choir and acted in school plays. He was a solid student and a good baseball player. He got a scholarship to play baseball at a local college. He eventually got an associate's degree. In 1972, when Yates was 20, he got married. The marriage only lasted 18 months. In August 1974, he got married for a second time. But it had to be annulled because his divorce wasn't finalized. His first daughter was born in December 1974. His wife Linda would go on to have four more children. Linda and Yates legally married in July 1976. In October 1977, Yates enlisted in the Army and became a helicopter pilot. He was considered an excellent soldier and he was awarded several medals. He was stationed in Germany, Somalia, and Haiti. In April 1996, after 18 and a half years of service, Yates abruptly resigned from the Army. This was odd because he was just a year and a half away from getting his full pension and benefits. That same month, Yates and his family moved to Spokane and he got a job as a circuit board manufacturer. He also joined the National Guard. Weeks after moving to Spokane, the first victim, 39-year-old Shannon Zielinski, was murdered. Yates only had one run-in with the law that wasn't related to traffic or sex workers, and had recently happened. In November 1998, his two daughters reported him for domestic abuse. The charges were dropped on the condition Yates didn't do anything similar in the next 2 years. The police also learned that on September 19, 1998, a police officer had stopped Yates and he was asked to give a DNA sample. He declined, saying it was, quote, too extreme of a request for a family man, unquote. In September 1999, after the police realized Yates had owned a white Corvette, he was brought in for questioning. He denied that he ever hired a sex worker in Spokane. The detectives then talked to him about the police report where he had been speeding. The officer wrote on the report he had been driving a Camaro. When the detectives said he was driving a Camaro, Yates corrected them and he said he was driving a Corvette. He said he sold the Corvette in May 1998. The detectives again asked Yates for a DNA sample and he refused. The interview made the police even more suspicious. In January 2000, the task force found the Corvette. The new owner permitted them to search the vehicle. The carbon fibers in the Corvette matched the fibers found on Jennifer Joseph's body. Based on this, the police got a search warrant for the car and tore it apart. Under the floorboards, they found a button. When Jennifer's body was found, the police noted that a button was missing from her blouse. The button matched the one on the blouse. Also, traces of Jennifer's blood was found on the seatbelt buckle. On April 18, 2000, 47-year-old Robert Yates was arrested for the murder of Jennifer Joseph. A DNA sample was taken from Yates. The same day he was arrested, it was compared to the killer's DNA. It was a match. His fingerprint also matched the print on one of the grocery bags on Sean McCullohan's head. The police then started searching Yates' home and vehicles. After he sold the Corvette, he bought a black cargo van with a mattress in the back. Yates' arrest was on the front page of the Spokane Review. Christine Smith, who survived her encounter with the man she believed hit her in the head, saw his photo in the newspaper. She was sure that Yates was the man who assaulted her, so she contacted the police. The details her attacker told her about himself, such as he was a helicopter pilot in the National Guard and had 5 children, matched Yates' life. Christine Smith's head was examined at the hospital. A doctor found bullet fragments behind her left ear. It turned out that she had been shot. She wasn't killed because the bullet grazed her. The bullet fragments were removed from her head. In the back of Robert's van, the police found a spent shell casing. Lodged in the roof was a bullet. The casing was a match to the bullet in the roof. An expert said that the fragments in Smith's head came from the same bullet. Smith's DNA was also found in the van. The police knew that Yates owned 3 guns, but none of them were found in his home. According to records, he owned a Raven 25 caliber pistol and a 22 caliber Harrington Richardson revolver. All but one of the women were shot with a 25 caliber handgun, and Jennifer Joseph was shot with a 22 caliber handgun. On May 18, 2000, Robert Yates was charged with 7 more murders and 1 attempted murder. Then in July 2000, Yates was charged with 2 more murders. But they were not any of the murders we've already mentioned. Instead, they happened nearly 300 miles from Spokane in the Tacoma, Washington area. On December 6, 1997, 34-year-old Melinda Mercer left a bar in Seattle to do some sex work. Her body was found the next day in a vacant lot in Tacoma. She had been shot 3 times in the head with a .25 caliber handgun, and 3 plastic bags were over her head. On September 17, 1998, 34-year-old Connie Ellis went missing after getting a dose of methadone. Ellis had a troubled life. She had 2 sons, and they both died young. One died when he was an infant from sudden infant death syndrome. The other died at age 11 from a heart condition. Ellis's family believed she turned to drugs to cope with her grief. Ellis's body was found in a ditch in Tacoma on October 13, 1998, about a month after she went missing. She had been shot once in the head with a .25 caliber handgun. On her head were 3 grocery bags. The police discovered at the time of the murders, Yates was in Tacoma for National Guard training. Robert Yates and his lawyer knew the evidence against him was overwhelming, so they asked for a plea deal. In exchange for life in prison without the chance of parole, Yates would plead guilty to the murders he was charged with, plus other murders the police did not know about. He would also reveal the location of the remains of Melody Murfin, whose remains had not been found. The district attorney asked the families of the victims to vote on whether they should agree to the plea deal. 19 people voted in favor of the plea deal, and 12 voted to take Yates to trial, where he could possibly get the death penalty. Going with the majority, the district attorney agreed to the plea deal. Yates confessed that he committed his first murders 25 years earlier. Yates was 23 years old at the time of the murders. He was working at the Washington State Prison in Walla Walla. He had shot to death 22-year-old Susan Savage and 21-year-old Patrick Oliver. This revelation surprised everyone. Yates had never been considered a suspect in their case. On the day of the murder, he was hunting when he came across Savage and Oliver. Yates never gave a motive as to why he killed Savage and Oliver. It is suspected that he had dark fantasies and homicidal urges for a long time. He then saw an opportunity to fulfill those urges and get away with it. He most likely would have never been suspected in the case had he stopped murdering after killing them. When Yates murdered Stacy Hahn in 1988, he was stationed in Germany. He was on vacation in Seattle. He killed the other women after picking them up for sex work. His plea that the women went with Yates, willingly performed a sex act which they were paid for, and then he shot them afterward. He put the plastic bags over their heads to stop the blood from getting into his vehicle and then dumped their bodies. Yates told the police where to find Melody Murfin's body. He had buried her in a flower garden outside his bedroom window. In the police's month-long search, they had never found the remains. In October 2000, Robert Yates pleaded guilty to 14 murders and 1 attempted murder. They were the murders of Susan Savage, Patrick Oliver, Stacy Hahn, Shannon Zielinski, Jennifer Joseph, Heather Hernandez, Darla Scott, Sean Johnson, Laura Wasson, Say Oster, Linda Mabin, McLean Durning, and Melody Murfin. He pleaded guilty to the attempted murder of Christine Smith. The district attorney did not charge him with 1 homicide. It was the murder of Sean McClellan. It was the district attorney's strongest case. Yates' DNA was found on the victim, and his fingerprint was found on one of the bags on her head. Plus, she was shot with the same gun as many of the other women. The district attorney chose not to charge Yates with her murder as a form of insurance. If he did something to jeopardize his life sentence, like lie during his confession or renege on the plea deal, they would take him to trial for McClanahan's murder and seek the death penalty. In October 2000, at the hearing where Yates pleaded guilty and was sentenced, he apologized to the families of his victims. For each victim, he said, quote, "To the friends and family of Susan Savage, I am sorry," unquote. Of course, he changed the name each time he said the line. Yates finished by saying, quote, "In my struggle to overcome my guilt and shame, I have turned to God. I hope that God will replace your grief with hope and your sorrow with peace," unquote. Robert Yates was then sentenced to 408 years of prison without the chance of parole. The district attorney in Pierce County, where the bodies of Melinda Mercer and Connie Ellis were found, did not agree to the plea deal. They wanted Yates tried for their murders, and they were seeking the death penalty. 50-year-old Robert Yates went to trial for the murders of Mercer and Ellis in August 2002. At the time in Washington, only someone convicted of aggravated first-degree murder could be sentenced to death. So the district attorney had to prove there were aggravating circumstances. Examples of aggravating circumstances include killing a police officer while they are on the line of duty, or killing someone in the commission of another crime, like rape. Yates' lawyer conceded that Yates killed the two women, but argued he should be guilty of first-degree murder and not aggravated first-degree murder. The prosecution argued that there were three aggravating factors. One aggravating factor was killing someone in the commission of a robbery. The district attorney argued that Yates picked up his victims and paid them up front for their services. After he had sex with them, he murdered them and stole the money he paid them. The second aggravating factor was that he killed them to conceal another crime. The district attorney argued that Yates killed them to conceal the fact that he was patronizing a sex worker. The third aggravating factor was that the killings were part of a common scheme or plan. The district attorney pointed out that Yates was a serial killer who preyed on other women in the sex trade. The trial lasted 5 weeks, then the jury deliberated for 2 days. 50-year-old Robert Yates was convicted of 2 counts of aggravated first-degree murder. A few weeks later, he was sentenced to death. He was sent to death row at the Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla. It's the same prison he worked as a correctional officer when he committed his first murders, the murders of 21-year-old Patrick Oliver and 22-year-old Susan Savage. It's believed that Robert Yates committed more murders than the 15 he confessed to. As part of the plea deal, Yates took a polygraph exam. He claimed he didn't commit any other murders. The police said he passed and was telling the truth. The newspaper, the Spokane Review, got a copy of the results. They sent the results to 2 polygraph specialists, and they said the results were inconclusive. On May 12, 1992, the dead body of 19-year-old Cherry Palmer was found in a gulch in a wooded area in Spokane. She had been shot in the head and the chest. A plastic bag was found over her head. The problem is, at the time of the murder, Yates was stationed at Fort Drum in New York, which is over 2,500 miles away from Spokane. But Yates had committed a murder while he was on vacation in Washington. This is what happened when he killed Stacy Hahn. He was stationed in Germany when she was killed. What if Yates killed Palmer? Why didn't he admit to it when he confessed to the other 15 murders in Washington? After all, he had confessed to the murders of Patrick Oliver, Susan Savage, and Stacy Hahn, even though he wasn't a suspect in their cases. Or is it just a coincidence that 6 years before he started shooting sex workers and putting bags over their heads and then dumping their bodies in rural areas, another killer did the same thing in Spokane? Another murder where Yates is the prime suspect happened when he was stationed at Fort Rucker in Dale County, Alabama. He was stationed there from July 5, 1995 to April 1, 1996. On August 10, 1995, 18-year-old Terion Corbett was found shot to death in a remote area near the base. Corbett had been shot several times in the face with a .45 caliber handgun. Corbett was a transgender sex worker who was last seen alive the night before. The police said it's possible the killer didn't realize Corbett was a transgender person. 9 months after Corbett's murder, Yates suddenly resigned from the army. It's possible that Yates didn't confess to this murder because it was in a different state, which would mean more legal problems. In 2018, the Washington Supreme Court ruled that the death penalty was unconstitutional. In 2023, it was officially abolished by the state. Robert Yates' sentence was commuted to life in prison. At the time of this recording, 72-year-old Robert Lee Yates, also known as the Spokane Serial Killer and the Grocery Bag Killer, is serving a sentence at the Washington State Prison in Walla Walla. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Like we said in the opening, if you have any cases to suggest for Into the Killing, Criminally Listed, or Paranormally Listed, please visit our website, criminallylisted.com. Well, that's all for this week. Thank you again for listening. Please stay safe and take care of yourself.